And now, business games.
Welcome to a bonus second discussion with Professor Ananish Chowdhury on experimental and behavioral economics and how we can use its learnings to set up experiments in business, to deal with biases, and much more. Part one was recorded face-to-face. Several weeks after that, part two was recorded as a virtual call. It is presented here with only very few additions. Both parts can be listened in tandem or as standalone episodes, though sequential listening is probably better. Though some topics are revisited, part two goes deeper and wider. After the mic went off at the end of part one, Ananish told me of his time as a visiting professor of public policy at Harvard Kennedy School in 2020, where he and research collaborators were using online experimental platforms to scale behavioral experiments. To start off part one, we jump straight into discussing how one used to need labs, but now can run experiments using online platforms. Without further ado, this is my second conversation with Professor Chowdhury. Enjoy.
So we were talking about sort of experimental ways of analyzing certain things. And one of the things I was saying is that even organizations or government departments can undertake experimental studies, right? So you can undertake some of these trials. So one way of doing some of these is you can do these now. There's Amazon's MTurk, which allows this, and I use this platform called Prolific in the United Kingdom. So Prolific has more than 100,000 people registered. So you kind of put on a study there, and it can be just a simple survey, but it can also be a somewhat interactive study. It requires programming, but you can put it on there, and then it sent out to all the registered users, and you get a lot of responses within a short period of time. And depending on the duration of the experiment, it may or may not be that expensive. So these are ways in which you can actually carry out kind of field experiments to study some of the questions, right? So one of the things, just to give an example, one of the things that we are trying to do now, you can even do this within organizations. So one of the projects we are working on is called Predict to Decide. Now, what does that mean? Now, you will probably be familiar with these things called prediction markets, right? Where you can enter betting markets where you bet on things, right? Some of these can be in the winners of US elections and things like that. Okay. So the evidence suggests that these prediction markets are actually quite good at predicting what the outcome would be. Mostly because people are betting money, they have an incentive to find out more about that. So they actually dig deeper than, say, you know, newspaper journalists and things like this. So there's a guy, I think he's at UPenn, but called Philip Tetlock, who has done a lot of this work. And he has a book out called Super Forecasters, which is quite useful. Anyway, now, one issue with the prediction markets is that you are really predicting something that you don't have control over. Right. So you are saying, you know, what are the chances of peace in the Middle East, or what are the chances Joseph Biden will win the US election, et cetera. Right. Well, one of the things we are trying to do now is, what if you wanted to do something like this? So within a large organization, you wanted to figure out what product or process you should be investing in. So let me give you a current example. Right. So, again, you can edit out some of these if you want. So let's say you are Pfizer or Moderna or Johnson & Johnson, and you need to figure out what vaccine to develop. Now, I don't know if you know this, but we are currently actually using two different types of vaccines, right? So the vaccine from AstraZeneca is kind of the old-fashioned vaccine. What happens here? Here, it's literally, we take a very small amount of a live virus and we put it under your skin. So your body reacts to that. And then you get a little bit sick, But the next time you actually get infected, your body will know how to respond, so you can avoid that disease, right? So that's the traditional. All the vaccines we have are like that. But the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines are not like that. These are what are called mRNA or messenger RNA vaccines. This is a completely different type of vaccine. Why? Because they work differently. So what happens with COVID-19, for instance, or any other virus, is very often they kind of invade the cell by sticking onto something called a spike protein. So it's kind of like they cling on to the cell via that. So what the mRNA vaccines do is they basically teach your cells how to recognize that spike protein. So it's not a virus. It's essentially they're sending a code to your cells saying, next time you see this spike protein or see this, remember this is a virus trying to attack you, right? And now this process showed more promise, and it was clear quite early on that these kinds of vaccines, if you wanted to get a vaccine in short order, you were better off investing in mRNA vaccines rather than the traditional old-fashioned vaccines, right? Okay. So now the question is, suppose you have this question, you're going to spend billions of dollars deciding to decide which one should invest in, right? Who do you ask? Now, you could potentially ask people in your own organization what they think is the right vaccine, right? Now, there's a big difference here, right? Because now you are not only predicting the outcome, but this prediction is, in, to use some jargon, endogenous, right? What you're predicting. So you are effectively predicting what you want to happen. So if I want the mRNA to happen, then I'll, if I'm the mRNA division, I will say, in mRNA. If I'm in the old-fashioned division, also that, right? So now there's an interesting interplay between what people's beliefs are and what they think should happen, et cetera, right? What we are trying to show in our current work is that you can actually design experiments where people are asked to put their money where their mouth is, and you can then take people's predictions and use those predictions to come up with the ultimate decision of which product or process you actually want to launch, right? Now, this is an intricate process because people have an incentive. If I'm in our mRNA division, I have an incentive to predict that. If I'm in the, you know, live virus section, I have an incentive to predict that. So the question now is, how do you aggregate those beliefs or preferences? So that's a fairly tricky theoretical question. What I'm trying to say, I don't understand the theory necessarily. What I'm trying to say is that you could kind of run even within organization studies. And even if you did it at a reasonably kind of crude, simplistic level, you probably get better data than what happens usually. What happens usually is the CEO makes a call by saying, I think we should do this, right?
So how do you, in terms of this work, is that something that you're undertaking right now, or are there early results? Like, what can be done with when you try to separate the incentives from beliefs and you actually want to extract?
So this is fairly novel work. This is very novel. There's a lot of work on prediction markets, and there's some theoretical work on these kinds of what are called decision markets, where you're essentially predicting what product or process we should be adopting. We have some answers, but we are still looking into this. What I'm simply saying is that you can do some of these things. But even if you forget that, what I'm simply saying is that rather than relying on kind of, you know, gut feelings or, you know, catchy phrases, the easiest thing to do in some of these cases is, if you want to make a decision, product, process, etc., get a bunch of people, get them to literally bet money, because that focuses their mind. And then that also provides them with an incentive to dig deep and figure out. But the point here, the crucial point here is that these are people who don't necessarily have any allegiance to the company or to the CEO, and can kind of are able to freely express what they think the true scenario is. So these kind of information gathering actually does better than sitting around a boardroom table and asking people, because as you know, what happens in a boardroom table is whoever starts out the discussion often sets the tone for the discussion that follows, right? Because they're no longer independent draws. You say something, somebody jumps in saying, yes, 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 I agree. And then the discussion goes in a different direction. And very often, one thing I find in various boardroom, across boardroom tables, is often it takes a lot of courage to say, you know what, I don't agree with that. And this is even more difficult if 10 people have already said, yes, 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 I agree. Then being the 11th person and saying, guys, people, hold on a second. That's actually very difficult. And most people don't want to do it. Right. And evidence suggests that government agencies and corporate boardrooms get horribly misguided by not engaging in that kind of second guessing in some, or, you know, what I say, playing devil's advocate.
And it used to be that you had to actually set up a lab, and you did set up a lab at Auckland University that is helping companies and government agencies to run experiments. But what you're saying is that nowadays you can actually, there are services that you can engage in. It's much easier. And so the barriers to that kind of, to entry to that kind of experimentation / information gathering are much lower than they used to be. Is that correct?
Correct. Absolutely. So you don't need a full-fledged computerized lab, etc., to do some of these things, partly because, as you know, it's also become a bit difficult to get people into these labs post-pandemic. But now, there's the ones I know of is Amazon MTARC and Prolific, where you have to spend a little bit of money. And this is different from kind of carrying on a market survey, because these are not hypothetical kind of responses. These are people who are actually logging in, taking part, and they're going to earn money based on what they decide. But the advantage is that these are a kind of representative cross-section of the population. You have all kinds of ages and education and gender and race. And these people are all taking part from their home. So they can take part if they want. So they all, if you're a registered user, you get a message saying, so-and-so is running a study. This study will last 15 minutes and you can expect to make £4. Right. So what these platforms are doing are really, they're kind of providing kind of a front end and a back end, in the sense that they kind of recruit people into your study. As soon as they sign up, they're going to kick them over to your server or your program. Right. And then at the end of the study, you will get the data, but you will direct them back to that platform, and that platform will take care of the payment. As long as you have an account there, you have to top up your account. And you have to make sure you have enough money in your account to do this. And they'll take care of all the payments and things like this. In the meantime, you can download the data and analyze it. And it's all completely anonymous.
And that's really the key, as just to compare it to the market research, is that we are trying to reveal preferences. And so there are monetary incentives, and we're trying to approximate as much as possible the real decisions, so
correct,
to speak, rather than just asking people,
correct,
what do you feel?
Correct. Absolutely. That this is a much better way of eliciting true preferences than simply asking people, what do you think?
Okay. So, cool. Let's move on to the next section. And I've structured these episodes in roughly four sections.
Right.
So there is an intro, then a lot of discussion. The third section is homework.
Right.
Because I used to train to be a professor, and you are actually a professor. So you can, why don't you set homework to the audience? And the homework is in two kinds. One is, What is the useful literature or, you know, other sources of information where people can read and learn about the techniques and concepts that we discussed? So that's one thing. And then second thing is, what are the tangible actions that people could undertake? And we've covered a number of these already, but maybe just summarize and add something that we haven't covered. Like, what can decision makers do to bring experimentation into their workplace?
Okay. So the first question is useful literature. Now, there are quite a few things out there. I strongly recommend the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And Kahneman has a new book out called Noise, which I haven't read, but it just come out. I ordered a copy. I have just published a book called Behavioral Economics and Experiments. That book is, it's a thick book. It's 450 pages. And it's designed as a textbook, but it's written in a very user-friendly manner so that anyone can read that book. And there are some technical sections where I say that, you know, you can skip this without losing anything, right? So that it can be used by, so if you wanted to know what is behavioral economics about, then my book kind of answers that question. And the reason my book is kind of unique right now, I'm sure there are other stuff, is that when people talk about behavioral economics, and we talked about this last time at the very beginning, people kind of talk about two kinds of issues broadly. One is this idea of bounded rationality and the fact that people make mistakes when they have complex problems and things like that. That's sort of the Kahneman approach, where Kahneman essentially says that, look, don't always rely on your system one or your gut feelings, but think about the evidence. You know, what you see is not all there is, there may be more to it, so things along those lines. But parallel to that, there is a huge economics literature on, say, contract theory or auction theory, right? And, or generally game theory. And all of that is based on certain types of assumptions of human behavior, that humans maximize an utility function. What is the utility function? Well, let's say the utility function is a function of payoffs. But now, we have enough evidence that people do care about other regarding preferences. People care about things like fairness. And a lot of these things matter quite critically when it comes to labor markets, writing, you know, wage contracts, interacting with other people or businesses, et cetera. There's a lot of evidence these so-called other regarding preferences, notions of fairness, et cetera, matter critically. So if you want to get a good handle on the first part of this, on this idea of bounded rationality, then Kahneman's book is pretty good. Dan Ariely's book called Predictably Rational is also very good. It's very funny. It's very easy to read. But those books are not going to, or do not discuss these other issues of kind of more what we have called interactive decision making, because most those are mostly kind of individual decision making. So my book does a lot of this interactive decision making things and what happens in real life. And the other way my book differs a little bit is I also talk about the role of probabilities, how we perceive. The fact is that we are not very good at probabilities, how we perceive it and things along those lines. Kahneman does some of that. So what I'm saying is that if you read Kahneman, you'll get a pretty good idea of how to make decisions in an individual context. But if you now want to think about interactive decision making or, you know, kind of scientific experimental tests of game theory, then you should probably take a look at my book, because there isn't really much out there. Now, tangible actions. So tangible actions is kind of following. So one of the assignments I ask my students to do is, obviously, you kind of have to read some of these things, right? So even if you have read Daniel Kahneman's book, right? So you are aware of these cognitive errors or biases, things like priming, framing. What I require all students to do is, especially if people who are actually working, is to go into their workplace and find one example of this kind of behavior, right? So it could be something that's happening now, or it could be something that can be done to, for instance, just to give you an example, suppose you wanted to tackle problem gambling, right? Are there particular types of messages that you can send to tell people, you know, not to engage in that behavior, right? Or to give an example, this has been tried out in different countries. In many countries, people don't pay traffic tickets, right? Or they don't pay them promptly, et cetera, et cetera. So are there particular types of messages that can be sent to these people to ensure compliance? Now, of course, you could say, well, how long lasting are these messages and things like that? But there are lots of scenarios in day-to-day life where you can apply some of these techniques to either say, well, this is something I've observed. Why is it like this? To understand that. Or you can say, well, this is something that doesn't seem right. Can I apply some of these techniques from things I have learned to maybe make this difference? For instance, sometimes excessive choices is not necessarily a good thing, right? So if you look at my book, I make connections to all kinds of decision making. For instance, medical decision making. How do you make decisions whether, you know, whether to send someone off to surgery or could you do without, etc. So let me give you one example, for instance, right? So recently I wrote this article about unconscious bias and what's happening with COVID-19 and things like that. Now, one of the things I wrote in there is this comes from a book by somebody called Atul Gawande. Atul Gawande is a medical person, but he's very well established as an author. So one thing Atul Gawande says is that he says that doctors often make a lot of mistakes in the process of surgeries, but pilots typically don't. So the number of mistakes made by pilots is actually a lot lower than mistakes made by doctors, which is a bit surprising because both of these people are engaged in a fairly complex kind of setup. And one of the things he says is that pilots have a checklist. So pilots go through a detailed checklist and they check everything off. Doctors typically don't. They kind of start the surgery and they go along. What he suggests is doctors should probably also have a detailed checklist as to who will do exactly what under what circumstances, right? Now, think about this for a minute. We all talk about, you know, Black people being, African Americans being shot by police officers in the United States. Okay. Now, maybe it's racist, maybe it's not. They're all, you know, you can argue on both sides of it. But the fact remains that altercations between African Americans and police officers often turn violent, while altercation between white or European Americans and police officers don't. Starting from the same crime, a broken taillight or, you know, drunk driving, etc. Right. So what's one way of avoiding this, right? So what's, I mean, in some senses, it is very difficult actually to argue that all these police officers are so completely and out racist. That's not quite the case. Certainly there's bias, but the bias tends to be quite unconscious in the sense that it exists within me, but I'm not aware of it, right? Now, the answer to this, the typical answer to this is to send these people off for sensitivity training, right? Oh, you know, learn about diversity and stuff like that. That's completely useless, right? It doesn't work. The evidence suggests it doesn't work. Because after the sensitivity training, what happens is people come out of it and say, okay, now I've gotten the training, I cannot be racist anymore. But that's incorrect. So how could we address one of these things? One answer would be to have a checklist, right? Because police officers always work in pairs, have a checklist where you go through a set of checks to say, under what scenario should I pull out my firearm, right? Now, that may not necessarily mean that less Black Americans or African Americans will be, you know, shot by police officers, but at least you can refer back to a rule by saying, look, you know, these were the rules, these were the steps, and in these cases, that threshold was crossed, and therefore we pulled the firearm. But if that threshold is not crossed, then maybe don't pull the firearm, right? So what I'm saying is that if you don't go by discretion or gut feelings or what you think is, you know, the right thing to do, but if you have a set of things that kind of force you to take a breath, step back and say, okay. And especially if you are kind of checking with somebody else who can act as a kind of a fail-safe, then you can avert a lot of these kind of mistakes. And for most of us, if you go around your workplace, you will find there are lots of these kinds of things that happen. And an awareness of this can show you that, well, maybe we don't have to do it like this. Maybe it's not so cost effective to do this. Maybe we can do this in much more efficient ways. But often it's simply just kind of questioning the existing status quo. All right. So that's that. I would say that's the homework, right? So go around and find something where you think, oh, this is an example of people relying too much on their kind of gut feelings and system one. Whereas, no, I'm not saying you shouldn't rely on gut feelings, right? But the other thing that people need to understand is that your gut feelings can be very, very helpful, but only if you have a lot of experience or expertise in the task. So if you are a soccer player, a baseball player, a football player, your gut feeling, or you know, even a firefighter, where you have to make split-second judgments, your gut feelings can be useful, but that's dependent on having a lot of expertise. But if you don't have a lot of expertise in something, then don't rely on gut feelings. For instance, don't go out, look at a house and say, oh, my gut says this is a great house. No, you don't buy houses every day.
Unless you're a property developer.
Correct.
Or an agent.
Correct.
In which case it's back to your point that that's the person with a lot of experience.
Correct.
And expertise.
If you do that as for your livelihood, sure. But if you don't, then don't rely on gut feelings. Do a bit of research. Same thing. If you're going out to buy a car, don't look at the car and say, it's nice and red and shiny. I like it. Do a bit of research on how reliable these cars are. So unless you have a lot of experience, relying on gut feelings, which is what we do a lot, isn't probably a good policy.
And experience is context dependent. So again, there could be a very experienced CEO who never did a mergers and acquisitions, or there could be another experienced CEO who specialized in mergers and acquisitions before. And so the second type would probably, when faced with a merger and acquisition scenario, would probably have a more reliable gut feel around that.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
It's just the question of if any time you kind of say, and we say this all the time, you know, what does my gut say? Or, you know, do I feel it right in my gut? You kind of have to ask yourself, do I have a lot of experience in this? Because these are what are called heuristics, right? These are rules of thumb that we use when we say, okay, you know, this is a complex problem. I can't think through all of this. I'm going to use my rule of thumb. Rule of thumb will be very useful if this is something you do a lot. But a rule of thumb may be quite wrong if this is something that you don't know a whole lot about. In that case, you might as well seek experts, and not people who report to you, but people who have no stake or who have no problem pissing you off, because you know that's when you know that you are getting kind of the correct feedback.
So a very good question. That's something that's been bugging me for a while. Are you familiar with Nassim Taleb's work?
Correct. Yes. Some of it. Yes.
Okay. So he's got one of his books is Skin in the Game.
Right.
And he actually argues that you should not listen to somebody who has no skin in the game. Whereas Kahneman, again, makes a point that, exactly as you said about the experts, is that if you have skin in the game, your judgment might be clouded because you're too emotional about something. And so it actually pays to listen to somebody who has no. I am struggling to reconcile these two points of view. And I suspect, again, it's context dependent. But what is your thinking about this?
So there, that's actually a reasonably complex question, because again, of course, yes, it's just kid. But see, the way we, let me see if I can answer it this way. So the way we get people to put skin in the game, right, is by typically paying them for their decisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
but they don't necessarily work for the organization or report to the person who will make the decision, because that's a moral hazard issue. So that's why we do experiments, not kind of survey questions, because you're essentially saying, telling people, if you think this is the right kick, right course of action, then you got to put your money where your mouth is. That's the skin in the game aspect. But see, the problem with the skin in the game aspect or that issue is you have to constantly distinguish between sort of these independent rows and information cascades. Now,
Explain what those are for the audience.
Okay, so independent draw simply means, suppose I want to know, I'm going to bet money on, let's say I'm going to bet money on whether interest rates will go up or go down. And we are betting money by investing or not investing, right? Okay. Now, I want to find out. I want to run an experiment to find out, will the Reserve Bank at the next meeting, will the Reserve Bank put the OCR up? What should I do? I should go about and ask a whole bunch of people what they think, and then I will say, look, either I will pay you based on whether you're right or wrong. If you're right, you'll get paid. If you're wrong, you won't get paid, right? These are in some sense independent draws, because I have asked a wide range of people who are kind of, you know, who are providing me with their predictions that are not biased by anybody else's predictions, that don't know anybody else's prediction. This is very different from going down a line of people where I ask the first person. So I have a group of employees. They all have skin in the game, right? I ask the first person, what do you think? And the second person, the third person, the fourth person. These are no longer independent decisions, because very often what the first person says is going to impact what the second person says, right? So yes, you want skin in the game, but you also want to make sure that these people's decisions are not being influenced by their fellow workers' decisions or other people's decisions, right? Now, maybe not, but what I'm trying to say, or what Kahneman is trying to say, I think, is that if you only look at people who have supposedly skin in the game in the Talib sense, you're probably getting some biased decisions there. Your chances of creating what I call this information cascade, where what I think is now is not no longer based on what I really think, but it's based on what people ahead of me said or what I think my boss wants to hear. I think organizations often find it difficult to distinguish the commitment aspect from this information cascade aspect. So yes, I want people who are committed to this, who have an incentive to say the right thing, or, you know, who are committed to the organization, but how do I distinguish that from their saying something which they think I want to hear? Right? So when I was department head, for instance, you know, people would often say, oh, you know, you are, you know, you should do this, you know, you have such great, you know, wisdom, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know, are they saying this because they think this is the really the right thing we should do? Or is they saying this because they think that's what I want to hear? Now, if you have some magic wand to kind of distinguish those two things, great. But very often we don't, because we like praise. We like to hear that we are correct, right?
Yeah.
So the answer to that is to then ask people who have no allegiance to you to say, what do you think? And then incentivize them in some form so that they have, you know, some incentive to do some research and say, okay, I think this is the right thing.
Hmm. Yeah, the reason I'm asking and the reason why I'm wondering about this is that there is a lot of discourse about the value of consultants. And, you know, on the one hand, they bring in that sort of outside, supposedly objective, you know, observation. On the other hand, they can say anything, right? Because they don't have to deal with the repercussions. So they can advise on something that may or may not be implemented properly, and they don't really have to think about implementation. And depending on which side you are on, there are very strong feelings about, oh, we should never hire consultants because they, you know, because they don't have the skin in the game, or we should definitely hire consultants because otherwise, you know, we're too biased. And you're right. It is a complex question, and it's a complex situation. And it's something that I would like to explore, I think, in more detail, but not within the confines of this, because it's I think it requires a special deeper dive and thinking about it deeper. But you've given
no, but can we just and provide a brief yeah, answer to that question? So I don't know the answer to this question, but I think that it also depends. So I find that organizations often bring in consultants to do things that the organization can do on its own. For instance, training people, right? You don't necessarily need outside consultants, because sometimes the consultants are using evidence that your organization, or university, et cetera, produced, right? But when it comes to doing something like an audit or some other compliance things, or, you know, did we do this right? Are we doing this right? Are the processes right? There, of course, you would need somebody out from the outside to come in and say yes or no, right? But the other thing that I'm saying is that increasingly organizations could probably do a lot of these things without consultants if they're willing to adopt an experimental approach, where they incentivize either experts or, you know, people within the organization, outside the organization, to provide anonymous responses, but the responses are incentivized, meaning that if you say we should move on to online courses or not, etc., then you need to understand that you have a stake, because that might happen, and then you'd have to deliver on that. Right. So if you have predicted that we should invest in mRNA vaccines, that might mean that you will have to work on that in a different lab than in your old lab doing the old fashioned vaccine, et cetera. So you could kind of strike a middle way by carrying on these things, which are incentivized, which are reasonably independent, without necessarily having to bring in external consultants. So it's kind of depends on the question, et cetera. But in some cases, you have to rely on outside expertise just so that you get the truth.
No, it's a good point. And my personal feeling is that I like the idea of the wisdom of crowds, so to speak.
Correct.
So when even in my own time, and I am a consultant, so I sell those services to others. But in my own tiny little company, I hire outside expertise, but I tend not to outsource stuff to them. I tend to engage with them. And the reason why I want to hire them is because they would give me something where I potentially could have a blind spot. So I don't know what I don't know. But if I listen to somebody else, either they reinforce what I already know, and then I'm feeling more confident that I don't have any blind spots, because because between the two of us, hopefully, it's much less blind. Or they tell me something new, which is great. I've learned something new, and then I can incorporate that information into my decision making, and then come up. So that's my preferred way of working with consultants in my own business. Okay, cool. The last section is basically typically a blurb of anything that you're doing that's relevant, because your book is centrally relevant to the whole conversation. So we've talked about that. I will put a link to the Amazon website or whatever, however you want to promote it. I'll put links to it. Outside of that, like, how do people find you? I suppose it's your website, because that's how I've been reading some of your writing. But are you on social networks? Like, if people want to reach out and actually talk about these things, do you do work outside? Do you do business consulting? You know, like, do you talk to businesses or government agencies?
I don't. I actually don't do at all. I am on LinkedIn. So people can reach me via LinkedIn. I have my website. I don't do business consulting at all, mostly because I do a lot of writing. So I do research, but I'm also doing a lot of books. So I have this book that came out. I have another book coming out in July. It's a much more scholarly book. It's called A Research Agenda in Experimental Economics. But the only point of interest there is that book, essentially, you could probably write a book like that for business purposes, but that book essentially tries to reach out to other disciplines, political science, sociology, you know, even health sciences, and say, look, you know, experiments can be a pretty useful tool in all kinds of other areas that don't think in terms of experiments. And here's how you can run some of these experiments. Here's how people are using it. So, for instance, we have a chapter on health. How do you promote healthy behavior? We have a chapter on sleep. For instance, what happens to decision making when you're sleep deprived, which happens to a lot of us, right? Shift workers, night shift workers, and things like that. What are the implications of sleep deprivation, right? So that book does a lot of that kind of thing, and you could possibly think of a parallel to the business world as well, but that's not what I've written. And I actually will have a COVID book that will be coming out I'll put it up on website. That's going to be a controversial book because I kind of taken more of an anti-lockdown stance. And it actually shouldn't be that controversial. I'm not sure why it became so controversial, because the point is very simple. The point is that when you lock down, you save lives, but you also kill some people elsewhere, right? So economists, so psychologists, we kind of talk about this, and this should be of interest to a wide variety of people. We talk about what's called identified lives versus statistical lives. And the terms are not very good, but the idea is that we focus a lot on things that are happening right in front of our eyes, right? So we say, you know, COVID-19, let's shut down, save those lives. But by shutting down, what's happening is, you know, other people are not getting treatment for their diseases. You know, millions of children around the world are not getting vaccinated, right? You are causing, by shutting down businesses, you're causing large-scale unemployment. We know unemployment leads to lower life expectancy, right? So what I'm simply saying is, look, there is a trade-off here, and it's not really a win-win. So it's not the case that by locking down, we have achieved our goal, because you are causing damage elsewhere. So one of the things I talk about is that you can do too little social distancing, where you are keeping the country or economy open and you're spreading the virus, which is not good. But you can also do too much social distancing, where you're shutting down to an extent where the economic damage becomes catastrophic, right? And this is a problem, and this is especially a problem. See, one of the other things I say is that in Western nations that tend to have an older population, COVID-19 has been a much bigger problem than in developing countries, which have a much younger population. So take a country like Belgium, for instance, right? Or in any of the Italy, San Marino, the median age in these countries is about 45. So 50% of people are more than 45, 50% less than 45. Now, if you take a country like India or Bangladesh, the median age is 25. What's the point? The point is the younger people are not as affected by COVID as the older people, right? Which means that the appropriate response for these poorer countries is probably not the same as the richer countries. And as a result, the economic damage to some of these countries, like India, for instance, has been catastrophic. And sorry, go ahead.
No, we discussed some of this in the first part, and of course the listeners would be hearing, I think, the whole thing together. Probably, I might release it in two parts. I don't know. It's one of those things where I think you mentioned the visible costs versus invisible
Correct.
Costs,
that's right?
Right?
That's
and
right.
And you know, it, in economics, I mean, one invisible cost is opportunity cost.
That's right.
Like
that's
you,
right.
You don't know exactly the counterfactual. You need to be aware of the counterfactual,
that's right.
And you need
that's
to
right.
be
that's right.
weighing that up. I personally think my personal feeling is on the side of the lockdown, and partly it's guided by having spent about 10 years in risk management, and within there we talk about expected loss, the probability of a loss, but also we there is a concept about the speed of development. And if something can get out of hand very, very fast, with a potentially catastrophic result, you might not have enough time to consider the things. And so in that case, it's fine to be, but that's my feeling. Again, I haven't done the modeling. I looked at all sorts of potential modeling of what people did, but I don't think, anybody converges on one right thing.
No, absolutely correct. But my point is actually much more kind of centrist. My point is that when I first started saying these things, economists were actually quite okay with it. Because the economists, they understood the opportunity cost argument. Right? So the economists basically said, sure. They said, oh, maybe I don't know if you're right. Because that's exactly what they said. They said, well, it depends on how you kind of process the base risk and how high is it, how quickly can it spread and things like that. But yeah, by and large, sure, there's an opportunity cost, right? Almost all of them were okay with it. But the medical science people just did not get the opportunity cost argument, which was bizarre to me.
And I have a lot of my family is actually in medicine, so I appreciate how they think, and I agree with you. I would say again, that's a topic that I want to. Well, let me start. My first season is experimental, right?
Right.
I actually want to dedicate the season two to all sorts of biases and all of that, and we touched on a lot of it. And you cannot think about decision making under uncertainty, whether in individual or strategic context, without thinking about biases and bounded rationality.
Correct.
So I want to dedicate season two to that. I want to build up to through then discussing data and basically statistics and distributions to discussing probabilities and bets, through to discussing game theory proper. And I think one needs to build up to that. I mean, this whole thing is called business games, for the reason that I want to talk about game theoretic concepts. And then finally, we'll build up to the discussion of complexity. But so I want to have these seasons. And so there will be possibly...
No, you don't. You can edit this out. I just mentioned that.
I don't want to edit this out, but I also want to point out that because it's important. It's important, but I think it requires a separate conversation.
My point is very simple. What a lot of people have refused to concede is there are arguments on both sides.
I agree.
Therefore, the decision must rise and fall on the basis of kind of the evidence, right? So for me, it's absolutely fine to say, well, I have looked at the evidence on both sides, and on balance, I think this is what we are going to do, right? If you paid attention to the debate, that wasn't what happened. The debate was one side is right, the other side is wrong, and therefore those guys.
I agree with you. I keep saying similar things, where a lot of people and decision makers in business or government go astray is that nobody thinks that sticking with status quo is a decision, but it is. Doing nothing is a decision.
That's right. You need
to weigh. So when you're thinking about a decision, it's not that you weigh pros and cons of something. You need to weigh pros and cons of decision A versus pros and cons of
doing nothing. That's right.
Which is also a decision. That argument is very close to my heart, because I see that in action, people not considering that as a decision, and therefore... I'm basically missing half of the thing. So I agree with that, and I want to explore. I think that's going to be a recurring topic through the whole thing. So when is that book coming out?
Not for a while. I'm just handing in the manuscript, so it's going to be 6 months or so. I mean, I've just signed the contract. So, but anyway, so I have this these two coming. Well, one is out already. It's on Amazon and elsewhere. The other one would be out. But that's, again, the second one, research agenda one, is more of a technical thing.
Yeah, I'm going to put you on the spot, but I could edit it. But these are the topics that, as I say, I want to have a deeper dive into these later on. So maybe if you have time, you know, in some months' time, we could have another conversation where we just focus on that, because I think it's really, really important. I even would say that the book for busy executives who want to read widely, a more academic book that links behavioral economics to medicine, for example, you know, that could be of huge importance to medical professionals in medical settings in management. So,
my COVID book is it's not a research book. It's not.
Oh no, I meant your middle one. Yeah. I meant your middle one. Yes. But the COVID one as well.
The COVID book is very simple. It simply says that, look, here are some counter arguments that probably should be thought of, but we don't have a lot of medical thing in. Well, we do have a chapter now on neuroeconomics, so these are, you know what this is, right? So there's a chapter that reviews the neuroeconomic literature that looks at kind of EEGs or MRI scans,
and in your middle, as you said, more academic book, the chapter on sleep deprivation, I think that's of huge interest to business professionals as well, because there are the times are changing, but there had been a certain, you know, kind of, especially in some cultures where the workaholism is seen as a badge of honor. People actually work themselves to the, you know, to the ground in a way, and then you can't make good decisions. So I think it's that is an important drawback of actually working too much.
But the sleep chapter also, I mean, this scheme, you can edit out some of this. We have gone over time, I think. So the sleep chapter also came out of, because that, I mean, some of that came out of work we did on what's called night trading. So we were looking at people who, so this is a published paper. I also did a podcast with a gentleman called Darcy Ongaro that's available on my website. So the question was that now, increasingly, more than day trading, a lot of people who do night trading, right? So these are people who stay up at night to trade on New York or London or Tokyo, et cetera. And the question was, what are the implications of that, right? So what we did was, again, this is an experiment. We had people playing from Auckland and United States, except some of this was, we had experiments at 4 a.m., 8 a.m., 12 noon, 4 p.m., 8 p.m., and 12 midnight. Which meant that, I mean, we had some groups, we had kind of groups in each of the locations, but then we had a bunch of groups where we had people from both locations with the idea that one of those groups, let's say one group would be playing at 12 noon, which is reasonable, which is a good time for most people on Earth. And one group would be at 4 a.m., which is a bad time for pretty much everyone, right? Okay. Now, of course, you can say, oh, these are not experts, they're not used to staying up, etc. But that's kind of beside the point. The people who do night trading aren't experts either. But what's the key finding? The key finding is that when you are sleep deprived to that extent, so people who do these kinds of things, and here's an easy analogy. The easy analogy is that when you're sleep deprived to that extent, it's like being drunk. What does that mean? What does being drunk mean, really? What it means is we severely underestimate the downside risk. So if you're really sleep deprived, then one implication is that you will be staking out fairly risky positions. So in our experiment, for instance, these are people who hang on, you know, there'll be a crash, right? There's an asset being traded, there's a bubble, and there's a crash. These are people who hold on to their assets for too long. And therefore, what happens is the people who are tired and sleepy actually lose at the expense of those who are not tired and sleepy. So those guys earn about a third more. So the point there is that, you know, and of course, in some disciplines like medicine, it's hard to get around this. But when you're excessively sleepy, you are going to make mistakes, but they're mistakes of a particular type. There are mistakes that come from being overly risk-seeking because you severely underestimate the downside risk. So in some senses, I talked to a doctor and he said that it's actually a doctor who has had a couple of drinks is actually in better shape than a doctor who has a surgeon who has stayed awake for 24 hours at a stretch.
And that's something that I totally do not understand about the medical profession is the 24-hour shifts.
I don't either.
They used to be 48-hour shifts, and it's like, for a profession that should be acutely aware of all of these things, like, how can it even allow that? I totally don't get it.
See, that's why I said people should read that book by Atul Gawande called The Checklist Manifesto, where he actually talks about some of these things, that why do things go wrong in surgeries? Why don't things go wrong as much in, say, you know, when planes fly, right? I mean, so anyway, so that's the kinds of things that, but as I said, I mean, you can actually now use experiments for all these kinds of things. You can do this with sleep deprived people. You can do this with doctors, and you can run these things.
Excellent.
Sorry, I just saw a LinkedIn post by John List today where I haven't read it yet. He has done this study on unemployment. It's a field experiment trying to understand implications of unemployment. Because one thing a lot of people say is that when it comes to macro type questions, you really cannot rely on experiments. But you can. I mean, you can take a lot of these macro questions and split them up into the component micro, like the asset trading thing. This is a finance macro question. Right? Asset market bubbles, property bubbles. So you can run a lot of cool experiments if you wanted to, and that gives you fairly usable data. Okay.
Excellent.
All right.
Okay. We've covered like over 1.5 hours, I think, between the two sessions. I think that's amazing. I will have a hard time editing
okay,
it.
No, but that's,
I might just release. No, totally not.
Sorry about that.
No need to apologize. This is great stuff because it's a lot of content. It's useful. These things are not light listening. So I think the content is good. I will add some comments, you know, pre and post, but
okay.
we'll go. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Ananya. Thank you.
That's amazing.
Thanks. Thank you.
I'll stop the recording now.
Okay.
And that was it. Tomorrow I'll be dropping another episode on this feed where I take one of the themes from my discussions with Ananish and I add some of my own thoughts. For now, I thank you for listening. Hope to see you soon. Bye.